Loud. Ian Robertson, neuroscientist and clinical psychologist. Welcome to Open Mind.
Hello, Keith. Nice to meet you again.
Well, thank you so much for coming along. And tell us, when did your interest into psychology begin?
I'll tell you. Long before you were born, there was only two television channels, and one of them there was a program called in black and white called Human Jungle. And it was this Harley Street psychiatrist,
okay,
who had these kind of glamorous, beautiful people coming to him with problems. And he worked out what the problem was. So it was exactly like Sherlock Holmes. So I decided I wanted to be a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
Age 12 or 13, going to be a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And then, horrors, when I discovered you had to do medicine. I didn't like blood.
Okay.
So I did computer science instead. And then quickly decided, no, I'll do psychology. And so I did that and never looked back, really. I mean, it's a fascinating area.
I have a question for you that people out there might want to know the answer to. What's the difference between psychiatry and psychology? A lot of people won't know the difference.
200,000 a year.
Yeah. in your favor.
I'm not a psychiatrist. No. Psychiatrists are medically trained and they're trained to diagnose.
Yeah.
And they're trained essentially, most of them, not all, to prescribe physical treatments for problems of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Psychologists, they increasingly diagnose as well, but they tend to try and use behavior to change behavior.
And we know for sure. I think it's accepted that the world is overprescribed and overmedicated now.
Oh, big time.
So, where is the problem with that? Where is the issue with that? Where there's so many people on so many pills, is it hard to distinguish between a problem somebody has where they might actually need medication, and like I'm pro science, pro medication, but like how does a psychiatrist or psychologist decide, I suppose, who needs medication versus who can actually use other techniques such as CBT or techniques you might have in order to help them with their mindset?
Well, the problem is it's much easier to prescribe a pill than it is to find therapists, you know, to who will do the CBT, which works and doesn't have side effects. I think the big fact is that the original studies that are done with, say, antidepressants are done with a highly selected group of people, generally with very specified set of quite severe problems.
Yeah.
But then when GPs start prescribing, poor GPs are kind of flooded with people with problems, what do? The range of people that get prescribed these things becomes wider and wider.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the state, and I mean, in Britain now, I mean, there's something like 80 million prescriptions per year for antidepressants.
Yeah, that's wild, isn't it?
On top of all the other things.
Yeah.
So the problem is because we live in a medicalized world where we've kind of bought into the idea of looking at our mind, and no one more than you knows how to change the mind. So what the problem with that is, we tend to think, oh, it's a thing. I have a thing. I have anxiety, or I have depression, so it becomes a thing that's outside of yourself that needs external treatment.
Yeah.
The problem with that is it undermines your confidence that you can do something about it yourself, albeit with help.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about learning, particularly learning to change thoughts or feelings, learning is a pain in the neck.
It's difficult. It's a process.
It's process, and it's up and down. Think of learning a new language or learning a musical instrument, Mike.
Yeah.
It takes thousands and thousands of trials, and some days you feel as if you've gone backwards. If you've got what Carl Dweck calls a fixed theory, if you've bought into a kind of I have a thing, then the first, you might try it for a couple of days and you'll think, oh no, I have a thing, I can't, this psychology stuff doesn't work. And that's the problem, but it does work, you see, if you stick with it, learn it, you know, because if you've thought in a particular way for most of your life or for a few years, How many thoughts have you had in that way? Probably hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you've laid down pathways in your brain that are really, really strongly established. And to overcome these pathways takes thousands of trials as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah, yeah.
Hard, mm. It's hard, you know. So that's one reason why we've gone down this, really big medication.
Well, it's repetition, isn't it? It's,
Absolutely.
And things get ingrained through repetition.
Yeah, yeah.
Negative thoughts get ingrained through repetition.
Yeah.
Negative behavior patterns. Like I find, just anecdotally, through friends, through some clients of mine, predominantly now these days, I deal with athletes or business people. But when I get them behind a closed door and I talk to these people, like it's really fascinating to me that they've all been diagnosed with something. And I find that hard to swallow a little bit myself because I just think, well, if I went now to maybe a person such as yourself or maybe a psychiatrist and I explained my life and I explained my mindset, I would definitely be diagnosed on the spectrum of something.
So would I.
For sure.
So would I.
So don't we all kind of have something, you know what I mean?
And, like, and what does it mean anymore to be diagnosed?
Well, that's what I'm questioning.
Yeah. Like,
do you think it probably has a counterproductive effect being diagnosed?
Yeah.
Because now I have something and there's two ways then to think about that. It's like I can either help myself solve this something or I can just accept now that I have a label and I can accept actually I'm going to have this problem for the rest of my life and there's nothing I can do about it. So I find that over-labeling also a problem.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on that?
Well, I do think it's a burden.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people feel it as a relief.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they've had usually anxiety, but also other feelings. And then someone says, you have ADHD or you have autism.
Mm.
And suddenly it becomes, that's why.
Yeah.
That's why. And so I can understand that. Now, a relative of mine with, married with two children, happily married, lots of friends, at age 50, had herself diagnosed by one of my ex-colleagues in Cambridge.
Okay.
Diagnosed with autism and started calling. And I was brought up trained autism, being these poor people. And you see them, and lonely young men and sometimes women, boys, swinging in their own repetitively in a swing part. And you think, I'm sorry, my relative who's 50, you do not have autism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You do not have the same thing as that poor boy who's self-stimulating and obviously not going to school in the swing part. I mean, there's... It does a terrible disservice to people with the core problems.
Yeah.
And I fear it does a disservice to many people who adopt the label. It may give them a temporary relief.
Mm.
But it kind of sabotages their faith in being able to change. And the thing is, I mean, you know as well as I do how changeable the human brain
is. This is it. Yeah, we're malleable for sure.
We've only got 20,000 genes.
Yeah.
That is not possibly enough to code for all our complex behaviors.
Mm.
So our genes evolve for our brains to be plastic, for neuroplasticity.
And explain to people what you mean by neuroplasticity. I obviously know what you mean by neuroplasticity.
Neuroplasticity means that the circuits in their brain, primarily the synapses, the connection between brain cells, and we've got 80 billion brain cells, and we've got... Each brain cell is up to 50,000 connections with other brain cells. And these connections are constantly changing depending on what conversations we have, what experiences we have, what we're doing, what exercise we're taking.
Yeah.
They're constantly, it's like a constant changing. And so whenever we do something, particularly when we learn something, you change the networks in this brain. You change physically the connections between your brains. And of course, when the more you do that, the easier it becomes to do the new thing you've learned because the pathways are there in the brain. But these pathways can be changed, but it takes time. The stronger they are, the more effort it takes to change them.
So how do people change their pathways?
Starts off with effortful, consciously controlled changing, deliberately doing things differently.
Like what? What do they do differently? Or what should people do
differently? Well,
so just for people listening out there who might be suffering from anxiety or lack of confidence, we'll talk more about confidence. What's one thing they could do now to be conscious of that?
So I'm anxious about social situations.
Yeah.
I avoid the coffee shop at work. I don't. So, and it's making me unhappy because I'm isolated and I'm anxious. So the best antidote to anxiety is taking action, is behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to go in to today I'm going to go into the coffee room. I'm going to give myself 5 minutes in there.
Okay.
I'm going to have a coffee. I'm going to not make any more demands myself. I'm setting a goal that stretches me a bit,
yeah,
but not too hard.
Okay.
And the moment you do that, the moment you stretch yourself and succeed in doing that, your brain immediately emits, the dopamine,
yeah,
neurotransmitter in the reward network.
Yeah.
And that's a mini antidepressant,
mm-hmm,
and it's a mini anti-anxiety.
But that's so important what you've just said. It's, yeah, mini antidepressants.
Yeah, yeah.
We can create these antidepressants in our minds.
Absolutely. You can change the neurotransmitters in your brain in different ways with different things. For example, the way you breathe affects the noradrenaline,
yeah,
neurotransmitter, which is part of the fight or flight anxiety system. You can, by the way you breathe, you can control that.
So what's a tip for people with breath work then? Like I'm a proponent of many different types,
yeah,
of breath work.
I use
different breath works depending,
yeah, yeah,
on. So I practice box breathing sometimes.
Yeah.
My main go-to is the Wim Hof method, even though, look, the Wim Hof method has actually been around for a gazillion,
yeah,
years,
yeah, yeah,
different guises, but like it's known now as the Wim Hof method. But what's your go-to yourself, perhaps,
The one I would most usually is just the 4-6 one. You breathe in for 4.
Yeah.
And out for 6.
Yeah.
And what that does
just
is...
just immediately you can feel,
yeah,
everything
you
change.
Feel different.
Just me doing it now with you, I can feel everything change.
And in our MRI scanner in Trinity, we showed that the locus coeruleus, which is the,
yeah,
little part in the middle of the brain that produces noradrenaline, its firing will change if you breathe in that way. So,
but people need to understand, sorry, yeah, for interrupting, yeah, but I, yeah, just want to hammer that home.
Yeah, yeah.
Like there's solid, yeah, neuroscience, yeah, behind,
oh,
this,
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
It's not fluffy stuff. It's
not out there.
It's not esoterical. Just a small bit of breathing can change the neurology of your brain. I just want people to really understand this, you know?
You have at your disposal the most fast-acting, side-effect-free and powerful and effective pharmacy in your own, through your own behavior.
I'm laughing and smiling because, yeah, how are people not recognizing this, do you think?
Because we've been brought up in a medicalized,
okay,
model of the world.
Yeah.
But if you take the other thing, what I said about the person socially anxious, just setting themselves a goal and achieving that goal, that's another, achieving small, making... creating small successes in your life,
yep,
it activates another neurotransmitter, dopamine.
Yep.
And that has these effects that I mentioned already. So once you start, what these two things do is if you do them, you start to feel more in control.
Yeah.
And feeling in control, particularly of your internal world, is a huge antidote against the external stresses,
yeah,
of the world. If you can feel a little bit of control, and you don't feel out of control of your emotions, that can be hugely positive, and you can build on that. There's something called the winner effect.
Yeah, okay.
Which means that in all species, including humans, your chances of having a further success are slightly increased if you have a success in a interchange with a person or another animal. So the small probability of the next interchange being successful, it grows exponentially.
Okay.
That's called the winner effect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the kind of engine of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can be skilled at setting goals for ourselves that stretch us enough,
yeah,
to give us that kind of... I did that.
Yeah.
I did that in spite of the edginess, in spite of the anxiety. That's a huge, that will make it much more likely that you can then set another goal that stretches you a little bit,
okay,
more. And that works like compound interest.
Well, I have a question for you on that.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'll have a suggestion. I'm getting a lot of emails, I would say recently, I've had them before, but I'm getting a lot more in 2025 than other years, of people who are scared of driving on the motorway and people who are scared of just driving on roads in general, but more the motorway than anything else. And obviously we want to keep these people safe if they're scared of driving on the motorway. And a lot of these people just won't drive on the motorway, but they need to. So what would be one mini step? Would it be a little step for them to take in order to help them stretch themselves? Create that winner effect.
Do 5 miles on the M50 on Sunday morning, 6
okay.
a.m.
Yeah, yeah, but there's nobody else on it. I love that. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. You know, I haven't given people that suggestion. Yeah, get up early, set the alarm,
and go
early on the M50 when there's nobody else
there. And then do 8 miles.
Yeah, yeah.
And then eventually then say, okay, well, I'll go at 7 a.m. on a Sunday, then I'll go at 8 a.m., then you gradually build it up.
That's that's a really
good suggestion. This is basic behavior. This is behavioral psychology.
Yeah.
This is behavioral. This is the B in CBT.
Yeah.
Cognitive behavior therapy is brilliant. But there's been a huge focus on the cognitive, mm-hmm. the thoughts that control your feelings,
yeah.
and not enough on the behavior.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Behavior changes your brain.
Yeah.
You act your way into a new way of feeling more than you think or feel your way into a new way of acting.
Now, you've written a book on confidence, how confidence works. I've noticed, again, a lot of, especially teenagers, are lacking in confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously there's adults as well, but the adults that'll be listening to this, a lot of them will have teenage kids, even younger kids than that. Why is it that in today's society, modern society, that a lot, like more than years ago, when I was a kid, you had the odd couple of kids who were lacking confidence, but now it seems that, you know, I would say, dare I say it, the majority of kids seem to be lacking in confidence. Why is that, and what can people do either to help those kids, or how can the kids help themselves?
Well, I'm going to give two answers, and this comes from Jonathan Haidt, the great social psychologist in the States, and that is lack of free play and and social media.
Yeah, and I'd agree with both of those, because look, I've got kids myself, and you know, me and my wife, we used to battle over this when the kids were young. You know, there'd be a giant tree and they'd go to climb the tree and I'd say, go as high as you can. Mm. My wife would be like, you can't tell them to do that. I'm like, no. And like, if there's a wall to jump on to walk along, you know, if it's dangerous, I would say, if it's dangerous, go do it.
Yeah.
And of course, like, I think we're wrapping kids in cotton wool at an early age. And the schools are a problem now, because now some kids aren't allowed to play basketball in the schoolyard and all that kind of stuff. So that obviously is a problem, in your opinion.
And even more is just rubbing up against other people.
Yeah.
On the street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so the skills in dealing with other people, dealing with bullies, dealing with, you know, the range of people, that these kind of skills leave people stripped of, frightened of if you like, of being exposed to unpredictable social interaction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the trouble with social media is when I was a teenager, I was a nerdy teenager, a SWAT.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had to be kicked out of the Sea Scouts at age 16.
Okay.
Because too much of a SWAT. We're too old. No, because we're too old.
Oh, okay.
All of us, all of the cohort of we'd never talked to a girl at all. There was the five or six of us, and our social life was playing gambling with three card brag on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
You know, But because that was our world, we didn't feel particularly lacking. Okay, yeah, we yearned for a bit of glamour and all that, but we did. Whereas now, if I was in that group now, I would know I was a nerd. I would be comparing myself with all these people having parties and sex and everything on social media, and you're comparing yourself with the world. So, and of course, comparison is the death of joy.
And so
it's that sense of being constantly evaluated, and the fear of being negatively evaluated. That's the biggest source of stress for human beings.
Okay.
Is the fear of negative evaluation by other people, as measured by how much cortisol, the stress hormone our body produces in response to it. And so what social media exposure does, and anxiety rates have shot up since 2012, since Facebook took over.
Mm-hmm.
We've exposed our children to this world where they're most of them are feeling inadequate or feeling they're failing in some dimension. Looks, weight, popularity, you know, parties, whatever it is, they're failing in these dimensions. And it's making this, of course, anxiety is the greatest saboteur of confidence. And so it's a huge, huge problem.
So Ian Robertson, what is the solve for this overconsumption of social media, which is affecting people's confidence? What can we do?
Yeah, well,
what can they do?
I don't think any parent, sensible parent, should allow their, I'm not sure of the age, but certainly under 14 shouldn't have a smartphone, should have no access. Their access to the internet should be in the kitchen table, laptop with their parents there.
I do agree with you, but I believe it's wishful thinking. And the reason I say that is I know just for my own kids, it generally starts around, now we stretched our son for a long time without having a mobile phone. Like, he was probably one of the last, I would definitely say, to get a mobile phone. So I fully agree with you. But I think it's mainly around the age of 12 now that they're on Snapchat and they say, this is the way I interact. Like, they look at me like I'm an alien. Like, what's wrong with you? This is the way I interact and this is the way I socialize.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't understand. So my own technique, which is the only technique I figured out that works,
yeah,
is literally distraction.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. So, like, doing other things other than social media. And the problem with that is a lot of children out there, teenagers as well, they don't have enough things that they can distract themselves with. So what I mean by that is it's not taking your time or my time as the parent. We don't have to be with them 24/7. I distract them as much as I can with, like, for example, board games. We're a gaming family. We play board games all the time. But when I say to my kids, like if I said to my son, get off Xbox, he'd go, we'd have an argument. But because he's into karate, he's into rugby.
Yeah.
He's into other things. He's doing those things and he just can't be on social media when those things are happening. And I know a lot of teenagers who don't have other things that they do.
Yeah.
And that's a problem in and of itself. So I've only found that distraction is a mechanism that definitely works. And it takes a lot of time. We're like taxi drivers now driving kids around. But look, it works, right? But what other techniques do you think might work? Now, I do think you're probably right. 13, 14 should be the age. I don't think we're going to win that battle. That was the problem.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about the age when it's feasible, but certainly primary school children should not be having it. You know, absolutely not. And I do agree with you about distraction as well. My five-year-old grandson is into GAA now, and that's just an all-consuming world that's just wonderful. You know,
it's great,
and it's fantastic, you know. And so you have to make sure that your kids have other things that give them that little feeling of reward that they'll get with the Snapchat. But the only other solution is quite a tough one, but is really, really, really realizing, particularly with artificial intelligence and everything, that everyone is going to have to become a kind of master of their own minds.
Yeah.
That they're really, everyone's going to have to become a very sophisticated psychologist. I mean, I'm a theoretical psychologist, you're a practical psychologist.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'm a practical brain hacker, but that encompasses psychology and lots of different aspects.
You hack the brain. People are going to have to learn to hack their own brains. Yeah. And that means you're going to have to add to the 3 hours reading, writing, arithmetic. There's got to be. So I can't think of the R for that, but you've got our own literacy, our literacy about our brains and our minds.
But don't you think, sorry for interrupting, because this is so important to me, and I'm very passionate about this, don't you think that from like day zero in primary schools, kids should be taught about their subconscious mind, about psychology, about how to deal with all these different things?
Absolutely.
And why is it not part of the curriculum? Like, well, you'd be more on point than
about that. But there is, you see, I'm just looking at my five-year-old grandson, there is a very nice a curriculum now in the national curriculum.
Okay, so it's coming
to do with naming your emotions. So there is a bit of that for sure coming in, but we need more of it. And it needs to be throughout the curriculum, and people will help with the kind of mental health crisis we're having as well. You know,
and people say with confidence.
Yeah,
you're very well researched, and dare I say, an expert on confidence. People say, fake it till you make it. Is that a true statement?
100%.
Okay.
100%.
Interesting. I definitely did that, by the way. That's why I was interested in your opinion on it. And I'll explain how I did it. But go ahead and let us know, what is, like, even just basic, what do I mean by fake it till I make it?
Okay.
So you go ahead.
Okay. So I want to do something, or I'm thinking about doing something, or I'm thinking about saying something to someone.
Yeah.
And I have that kind of, I'm not certain this is going to work, okay? There's a downside to this. There's uncertainty. And I've got that anxious feeling in my stomach. Can I do this? Confidence is what bridges uncertainty. It bridges that gap.
Mm.
If you're 100% certain that you can do something, you don't need confidence.
Yeah.
That's an established habit. So that's why if you get someone who's a public speaker or a performer, and they go out and they say, I don't feel any anxiety. I love it. I go on.
Yeah.
That's not confidence.
Mm-hmm.
That's habit having been developed.
That
they're just exercising habit. Confidence is only called upon when you have uncertainty and the anxiety that uncertainty causes. And that's why confidence is the biggest antidote to anxiety. And that's why taking action is the biggest source of confidence. particularly taking action in spite of anxiety.
Okay.
That gives you a sense of triumphing over adversity.
So that's why even if you feel that anxiety, fake your confidence to push you to
take action. Exactly. So even you know, you want to have a difficult conversation. It could be with someone you're having a relationship with, or a boss. And you know, the tendency is you want to make yourself small, you know, because it's a primitive unconscious submission gesture. You probably want to be speaking a bit quietly because you're speaking to a dominant person.
Mm.
You might be avoiding eye contact, you know.
Yep.
All of these are submission signs. Often you're not aware you're doing them because you're so anxious you can't monitor. Mm-hmm. You don't have space to monitor your own behavior. So what you have to do in advance is practice these things.
Yeah.
In your mind, both physically, but also in your mind's eye. Excuse me. And one by one, okay, I'm going to sit tall. I'm going to remember not to make myself small.
Yeah.
I'm going to practice speaking, not garbling, not making, I'm going to get the volume right.
Yeah.
I'm going to practice appropriate eye contact, not inappropriate, eye contact.
Yeah, not staring you down.
Yeah. And then, so I remember I had a, so this, these are about setting internal goals for yourself.
Yeah.
Internal goals for yourself. Can I do this? Now, Tiger Woods, the big golfer, he says the day he's not nervous when he goes on to the golf course is the day he gives up.
Yeah, because he doesn't care. If he doesn't have nerves, he doesn't care.
Exactly. But also, if you have nerves, what that means is your brain's generating more noradrenaline than you.
Yeah.
And there's a sweet spot for noradrenaline, as there is for dopamine, where too little or too much, and your brain doesn't perform as well.
Yeah.
There's a sweet spot. And what people who get themselves anxious, and I'm sure you get, you know, need that before a performance as well, you're getting your brain into a state, the sweet spot, where you're getting optimal performance.
Yeah.
Different parts of your brain synchronize better with just that right amount of noradrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why... anxiety and excitement have the same physiology in the body, and they only become one emotion by the label we put on it.
Okay, yeah.
So if we name these symptoms, the anxious, I'm not sure I can do this. If you reframe that as, oh, I wonder if I can do this in spite of these feelings. Oh, I think I can do this.
Yeah.
That changes it from a threat into a challenge. And when you start to think that way, that's when you get... The winner effect coming into and the confidence building.
It's really interesting. So when I was 14, I used to be in talent shows all over Waterford. So that's where I began my journey into magic and mentalism. And in these talent shows, I would have a prop in my hand. Let's just imagine this is a prop so people can hear this. I've got a sheet of paper in my hand. And my hand would be shaking so much with a prop in my hand. Like, you can hear that sheet of paper. Like, I would be shaking. And it took me years to get over, like, that lack of confidence that I had until somebody once told me, fake it till you make it. And
yeah.
I was like, what do you mean by that? And they said, look, you've got to fake your confidence until you gain that confidence and that confidence becomes real. But here's the fascinating thing that I want people to know. I like to show my vulnerable side here on Open Mind. So like last year I performed in Bord Gáis, 2,000 people, it was sold out. I was confident going on that stage because I knew my material.
Yeah, yeah.
I was still nervous.
Yeah,
I care.
Yeah.
But I had confidence going. But here's an interesting story just from the last week, right? So sometimes I still lack in confidence.
Yeah.
So people ask me all the time, where do you get your confidence from? Like, I have an absolutely, I suppose, confidence mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes I lack in confidence. Here it is. I was in an airport last week. I can't even remember. I fly so much. It might have been, I think it was coming out of Heathrow. But ultimately, anyway, we got on the plane. Oh, sorry, just before we got on the plane, Natalie Imbruglia, the singer, was there. She was in the airport. And I was like, geez, that's Natalie Imbruglia. And nobody recognized her. You know, she'd played with the chorus the night before. And I'm a fan of Natalie Imbruglia's. And I was thinking, do you know what? It'd be great to go over and say hello and do a quick brain hacker on her. And then that'd be great for my social media. And I'm sure she'd be okay with it. Nah.
No.
She might say no. So I'm not going to go anywhere near that. And I just left her alone.
Yeah, yeah.
And I regret that because I think she probably would have said yes. And would have had a brain hack. And it would have been fun. But here's the fun thing for listeners to know. Natalie Imbruglia, she's a very polite human being because on the way onto the plane, I lifted a buggy fur lady off of the little bus that we were on. And on when we landed on the other side, I was away from where the buggy was. Natalie Imbruglia lifted the buggy from the lady. So it was lovely to see. But ultimately, I regret not saying hello to Natalie Imbruglia. I didn't push myself with the winner mindset to go over and say hello because for fear of rejection, I suppose.
And the thing is, when we're feeling that lacking confidence way, that kind of anxious way, we become more self-aware. Mm. So we become so aware of our own thoughts. And we kind of tend to assume that other people are mind readers and that they can see our self-doubt. Whereas most people are preoccupied with their own minds.
Yeah.
And so what feels to you as fake, you assume that they will see the fakery.
Mm.
But they don't. They see the outside manifestation. Now, she was probably bored. Would have been delighted to have a little bit of interesting interaction and brain hack with you. But you were kind of almost projecting your doubts into anticipating what she was going to do.
Yeah.
And of course, so just do it. That's the thing. Just do it.
Push forward.
Almost use when you feel that, that kind of holding back, that kind of anxiety, that kind of, almost use that, that's a sign I must do it.
Okay, that's good now. That's
so I go swimming in the sea, something, paddling in the sea, year round. And
dipping, I call it.
Dipping, exactly. And for a while, I had to really, because I only did it once a week, particularly in winter, I had to steel myself. And you'd be a Sunday afternoon or a Sunday morning and say, will I do it? And what I learned was once you had that thought, you had to make that thought the cue that you had to do it. The fact you were thinking it and you had to do it.
Yeah. So if it comes into your head, do it anyway.
So that's the same with anxiety. But whatever the domain you feel anxious about, if you find yourself in that mental dialogue, will I, won't I?
Yeah.
Say, okay, that means I have to.
Okay.
I have to.
Great.
The moment you realize you were having that debate with yourself, you should have gone over.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it happened to me in the States as well. I grasp 99% of my opportunities, right? And I am confident in those moments. But I was hired to do an event, I think it was last year, for Dwight Freeney, who's a very famous NFL footballer. So I was flown over to middle of nowhere, this gigantic mansion for Dwight Freeney's inauguration at the Hall of Fame, and some mega famous basketball player, like the most famous of all time, not Magic Johnson, the other one. I'm not into basketball, I forget who it was, but when I say the name, I actually forgotten who it is, but like the most famous basketball player of all time besides Magic Johnson, he was there. And I was just like, nah, I'm not going to bother. But me saying I'm not going to bother was actually me being not confident enough to go up to him and actually perform. So it's just interesting that from now on in, just having had this conversation, I remind myself. Just do it anyway, Keith.
Do it anyway. And 1 in 10 times you'll get put down.
But I think it's important for people to understand that even somebody who is, I am a very confident human being, I still have those moments where the lack of confidence creeps in. Do you have those moments?
Of course I do. I pull back from things that I regret later. I can't think of any examples just now, but for sure. The thing is, confidence is not like self-esteem. It's not a general purpose view of yourself. I'm a confident person.
Yeah.
It's always linked to specific situations and specific categories of behavior.
Yeah.
So you can be really confident socially, but not confident academically. You can be very confident in your work or sport and not confident socially. So it's all about action and behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And the confident self-esteem can hold you back in life because you spend so much time trying to protect it. Confidence works because it's linked to action in the brain. And if you feel... If you believe you can do something, and there has to be uncertainty in that belief, so it's a kind of almost an act of will. I know there's a chance that I'll be rejected or made a fool of by, So I'm accepting, I'm pricing in that risk,
yeah.
that downside. Okay, I believe I can do it. When you say I believe I can do it to yourself, when you get that feeling,
yeah.
your brain treats it as if you've successfully done it. So you get a little surge of dopamine in the ventral striatum of your brain.
Yeah,
and that's five. Along with other things, has five effects on you. It makes, as I mentioned earlier, it's a mini antidepressant, mini anti-anxiety drug. It motivates you and makes you more likely to do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you a little bit smarter because of the extra dopamine in your prefrontal cortex.
Yeah.
And finally, it makes you more persuasive.
Okay.
Which in your game...
Interesting. Yeah, it's key.
It's key. I mean, you're persuasive. You know, if you weren't charismatic and confident, you would not be persuasive.
Yeah.
And that just makes other people do what you want.
Yeah, and look, I find that really, really interesting. But besides CBT, right, I've heard people say this. I think they're wrong. I think they just haven't... So I'll say the statement first. A lot of people have said to me, I tried CBT and it didn't work. And why I say I think they're wrong is they didn't stick with it long enough, right?
No.
And it requires discipline, it requires practice, it requires time.
Yeah, yeah.
Different times for different people. I say the same with hypnosis when I use hypnosis. But let's just imagine for a second, people out there listening, they say, well, I've tried hypnosis for anxiety or confidence. It didn't work. I tried CBT. It didn't work. Is there any other fields or techniques that you found that actually you see these actually really do work also?
Well, I mean, there've been lots of scientific studies of different types of psychotherapy, you know, and a lot of them have, depending on the individuals, can work. Mm. So sometimes you have to try different people and different methods. CBT would be my
go-to
one. And but the problem is, people usually under both therapists and the users. Tend to underemphasize the B part of the CBT, the behavior. So, for example, it's almost impossible to panic if you're breathing slowly.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So if you can develop the habit of breathing, doing the 4-6 breathing, or another version of that is to breathe in and then take an extra little breath and then breathe out slowly. That extra little breath puts extra pressure on receptors in your lungs, which influence the vagus nerve firing, and produces the parasympathetic nervous system, dampening down the kind of anxiety effect. So, if you've done that several hundred times, offline on the bus or sitting at home, and now suddenly you're in that really tense, difficult situation.
Yeah.
You'll be more likely to remember to do it.
Okay.
And if you do that, if you breathe slowly, it's much harder for the panicky thoughts parts of your brain and the tension. You're kind of disrupting the team. By breathing slowly in the middle of this. So it's almost sometimes it's about changing one behavior.
Yeah.
Can disrupt what is a habit, a whole pattern of habits associated with anxiety, avoidance, panic, etc.
You've mentioned the vagus nerve there, and right now I've noticed on social media there's, I suppose, a movement towards stimulating the vagus nerve, settling the vagus nerve.
Yeah.
Explain to people, what's the vagus nerve and what effect does it have on our body?
Well, the vagus nerve is connects your intestines with your brain via the heart and lungs.
Yeah.
And it's our whole internal world is regulated by the vagus nerve, and it's stimulating the vagus nerve. So this our what's called the autonomic nervous system, which is the one that makes us sweat and heart beat fast, etc.
Yeah, blood flow, everything. Yeah.
So there's a sympathetic one, which is what happens when you're anxious, you know, and then there's a parasympathetic. So the two of them are in opposition to each other, and stimulating the vagus nerve, one of its effects, apart from lowering noradrenaline in the brain, is to dampen down this sympathetic activity, which is associated with anxiety and panic.
Mm-hmm.
And the breathing's a great way. There's a great way of stimulating the vagus nerve.
I've noticed a load of people online slapping themselves. They're doing this tapping.
Yeah.
Have you noticed tapping here on the shoulder and the tapping under the arms, and then wiggling their bodies and they're set, and then they do an and all this kind of like. Is there like, have you looked into any of that?
Well, I mean,
for the vagus nerve.
The great thing about all of these is you mentioned distraction. I mean, if you what you're doing is you're what these things can do is break habits.
Mm.
So if you're feeling very anxious or panicky, you've got a whole set of thoughts that come into mind, and these thoughts are linked associatively in the brain with certain patterns of breathing, for example.
Yeah,
and these are linked with certain feelings and certain memories will be more activated. So you've got this whole set of different things that are connected together in one big habit.
Yeah.
If you can change any one aspect of that, you disrupt the whole habit activation.
Okay. Yeah.
So I imagine with the tapping, I don't think there's been any scientific studies done of it, but I imagine the essential thing there. If you're thinking about tapping your shoulders, and you're breaking the habits of thinking,
yeah,
because you're distracted
by
something else. And you know, people have different ways of doing this. I mean, there are other ways of stimulating the stretch receptors, you know, the detectors of the vagus nerve, to do with looking up right and looking up left. I haven't looked into the scientific data on that.
Yeah.
I think people can experiment with ways and you know, by all means, tap yourself if that helps you break these habits of feeling, thinking, and
whatever behaving, works, right?
Whatever works.
Once it's healthy and beneficial, detrimental.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I suppose on that, when we talk about healthy, not detrimental, and you mentioned like we can have or create an antidepressant within our own mind.
Mini antidepressant.
And as I said, I'm pro-medication, as I assume you are. Certain cohort of people can't just hack their own minds or get somebody else to help them hack. But there's a movement now towards the psychedelics. Have you looked into this?
A little bit.
Where do you think it's all going?
For a start, I'd be very cautious about people experimenting themselves
They shouldn't do that.
I mean, I had a few. I remember, you know, because when I was at university, you know, I can think of three or four people who ended up with psychotic breakdowns after.
And I know LSD. Some too. Yeah.
And their lives were just ruined.
Well, I know some. After LSD, but after. What's the other one? Ayahuasca. Ayahuasca.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I've had people come back changed from ayahuasca, and they think they've changed for the better. But it turns out, from the outside looking in, you haven't changed for the better. You're like, they're gone off on a tangent in life. That's probably not a good tangent.
That being said, there's some interesting research being done under proper supervision. Mm. You know, I think it really has to be done under proper supervision, you know, by skilled, you know, people that maybe in things like, well, certainly in terminal illness and maybe even in certain addictions, maybe what you're doing is shaking up some of these big networks of habits that have been built up in the brain. Yeah.
Tell me this, let's talk about lies. Is it ever healthy, do you think, to believe a lie?
Well, I believe I'm going to live forever.
There you go. Yeah.
Denial. I mean, we all trick ourselves all the time.
Yeah.
You know, denial is part of living, really. Mm. The problem with lying to other people is not a good idea, because the whole basis of human relationships is trust.
Yeah.
And if you lie, and then you're breaching trust. And that really is corrosive of human relationships. But lying to yourself,
The reason I ask that question is because, like, I think people out there need to tell themselves healthy lies, right? They need to tell themselves, I am confident, I am good enough, I am strong enough, I am powerful enough, I do have enough time, I do have enough energy, I have enough resources, I have enough friends. Because I think an issue right now is that people are just readily accepting the negative thoughts that come in.
Oh, yeah.
And then we ultimately end up with that victim mindset.
Oh, yeah.
And I find a lot of people are sitting in that victim mindset. And I find it quite sad, because, you know, we'll just take a random person, we'll call them X. And that random person X, look, they might suffer from some mental health problems. They might be, you know, very overweight. And then you or I, as their friend or as their colleague, they might we might suggest something very simple to them.
Yeah, yeah.
That they can, that'll definitely help them if they do it. But they'll say something like, ah, I've tried that, or yeah, I'll give that a go. But then they don't ultimately. And the reason I say that is there's a lot of people out there with this victim mentality. And it's happened previously, but again, I think it is probably a social media thing where there just seems to be a lot more people than there should be sitting in that victim mentality. And is there a way to kind of bounce people out of that, I suppose?
Yeah, and the trouble is that, you know, telling people to, well, you should do that.
It never works, right?
So, actually, for a lot, if people can find a purpose in life,
yeah,
if people can discover a purpose in life, that can then be the internal engine that gets makes them say, oh, yeah, maybe I should do that. And one little exercise that the psychologist Desi and Ryan in Rochester did was called self-affirmation, which is where you ask people, what do you stand for? What are your values? What matters to you? What matters to you in life? Is it your family? Is it integrity? Is it hard work? Whatever it is, what are you? And sometimes the very acts of saying, well, what are my values? You know, and then why do you hold them, and what do they mean to you? And just that evidence of just 2 or 3 minutes of people doing that, they become less, their egos become less vulnerable to criticism. Mm. And you can see this in the brain, and the amygdala activity goes down, for example. So I just wonder about, you know, people like your ex you're describing there, whether, you know, just going back to basics, saying, well, what do you think about life? What are you for? What's your purpose? And you don't, this doesn't have, for some people that can turn to religion, but for most people it's not necessarily. You know, I feel angry about what's happening in the world. Well, you know, are you doing anything about that? You know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that exploration of basic values, it's called self-affirmation.
Yeah.
People can suddenly find a purpose, then linking that purpose to saying, well, maybe you should go and start joining a group, to activist group, or maybe you should start volunteering in the Oxfam shop or whatever it is. Just small actions. And once people take the small action, I mean, that changes them in a way no talking or thinking will necessarily change them.
But I would bet that 90% of people listening to this right now do not have their values defined.
No.
They think they know their values because they've gotten them probably from their parents, their preachers, their teachers from childhood, whatever.
Yeah.
So they would say, well, I'm an honest person.
Yeah.
That's one of my values. Yeah. Or, you know, I'm working hard for my family, and that's my value. Actually, I do this often. I'll sit down and I'll write down my values. I'll do as best as I can to make sure my life is aligned to those values, knowing that I'm going to fail and I'm going to be wrong sometimes. So I always say to people, I don't want to be put up on a pedestal, and I don't think any professional speaker, brain hacker, mentalist, psychologist should be put up on a pedestal. We all have our flaws and so on. However, I think it's so beneficial what you've just said. Like, take 2 minutes today, if you're listening, to write down your values.
Yeah.
Just five of them, even. Top five.
Top five.
It's like mine is... It's not what you think it is. I already know that I spend enough time with my family because I've got that aligned for a long time, right? And I already know certain other things. But like, one of mine is curiosity. Mm. One's adventure.
Yeah.
I need adventure in my life, right? Yeah. I'm a get up and goer. I'm an outside person. Yeah. I need adventure. I need to be at least twice a year. I need to be either jumping out of a plane, or I need to go to a seminar that's wacky and weird and wonderful, or I need to be up a mountain or whatever it is. Curiosity, adventure, then integrity.
Yeah.
I seek for integrity in other people and so on. So, but they change over time.
Yeah.
That's the fact. So I say to people, once every 3 months, write down your values. Mm. And you'll notice that every 3 months, one or two of those will change.
Yeah.
Then if you write it down once every 2 or 3 months, you'll always at least attempt to align yourself
with
your purpose and values in life and aim towards that.
Yeah.
And tell us, what are you working on at the moment before we wrap it up? What's going on?
Well, I'm writing a book called Keeping Your Edge, the Neuroscience of Aging Smartly, because there's a myth in neuroscience and in medicine that from about age 28, you're on your brain's in a steady decline. And you know, that's based largely on reaction time data. Mm. And so having looked at the the data, I realized that what your edge is a combination, is not just your speed of thinking. It's four things. It's your speed of thinking and your drive.
Okay.
And that affects your intellect, and it's your judgment, and it's your social emotional abilities. And your edge actually is the balance between these four things.
Okay.
And we can really end up maturing our brain till quite late in life. Not everyone, but a proportion of people can end up smarter.
Ah.
With higher levels of edge.
There's hope for us.
Totally
all.
Self-interested hypothesis.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested. Like, I'm getting on to 48 as well. Before you go, yeah. I want to try something with you.
Yeah.
Brain hack, right?
Yeah.
So I want you to imagine just for a second.
Yeah.
On this table here in front of us.
Yeah.
Are all of your different psychology books, the ones you've written, the ones you've read. So stare at the table for a moment and just imagine they're all spread out there. Yeah. And in each book, there's probably between 30 and, I don't know, 60,000 different words.
Mm.
And imagine there's hundreds of books there. And just imagine all of those words floating in front of you. And imagine them floating up from the table.
Yeah.
And now just see one word between us.
Okay.
One word out of many.
Yeah, yeah.
And for people out there listening and probably watching on social media, like, there's no way I could know what this word is. You haven't told me the word off camera or anything like that. Okay, look at me. Now, focus on the number of letters in the word. You said yes straight away. Now, stop. From a psychological perspective, you said yes too fast. So now I know you didn't have to count in your head. So I know it's either 3, 4, or 5 letters long. Is that correct? One of those.
That's correct.
Okay, good. All right, try not to give the game away in your head. Like, try and shut me down.
Yeah.
Okay, so now in your mind, focus on the letters. And you mentioned... You were talking about the alphabet at one stage earlier off camera. So I want you to imagine the alphabet in your head.
Yeah.
So look at me. Imagine the alphabet in your head and say the alphabet out loud.
A, B, C.
Backwards. Starts with Z.
Z, Y, X, V.
W. You missed the W.
Okay.
But you see, you skip past W and then you went to V, U, T, S, R, Q, P, O, N, M, L, K, L, J, H, E, F, E, D, F, L. Your lips moved on an E. There's an E in the word somewhere. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. I know. Did you notice yourself biting on the E?
I did not.
Focus on the position of the E, like where the E is.
See,
you did that too fast again. You went, yeah. So most people would have had to count where the E is in the word, but you didn't have to count.
No,
so in your head, did you just say, it's in the last position?
Yeah,
did you
yeah.
say that in your head? Did you?
I did.
Yeah. Okay, one word out of...
I'm impressed.
One word out of thousands and thousands and thousands.
Yeah.
Hundreds of... No, don't say the word out loud. Never
okay,
say the word.
No,
just
no.
say the word in your head.
Yeah.
Make it louder in your head. Okay, I'm going to write something down here. I'll show the camera first so that I'm locked in. Okay, there's a camera there. There's also a camera over there. Name out loud. What was the word?
Pope. Jesus.
Exactly what I got.
I am so dumbfounded.
I love dumbfounded psychologists.
I am dumbfounded. Well done, you.
Ian Robertson, where can people find you?
Find me at ianrobertson.org.
Deadly. Thank you so much for joining us here today. And
thanks. Thanks, Keith. It's been a fantastic talking to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Cheers.
Okay.
Deadly.
Jesus, that's amazing.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow, rate, and share wherever you get your podcasts. It helps others find the show, and it means the world to us. Thanks for listening. Keith Barry's Open Mind is a Go Loud original podcast. Our producer is Oran O'Halloran, and the executive producer is Pamela Blake. Darren Murphy is our video producer.